I can't believe that there isn't someone whose job it is to pay attention to this stuff.
Confronting Alaska's massive and potentially costly shipwreck problem. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 14th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new study documents Alaska's largest glaciers, all 2,000 of them.
When you look at the last 60 years of temperature records, there is almost a 4-degree Fahrenheit increase in temperature throughout the state. So that's having a major impact on why the greatest majority are retreating.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Dena'ina Civic and Convention Center opening celebration is Saturday, October 18th and Sunday, October 19th. There will be a variety of big, wild events, free and open to the public, with family-friendly activities, live entertainment, and an oxygen and octane expo. There'll be a street fair along F Street featuring the new Anchorage Convention District. Information on the events is available online at anchorage.net. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Convention and Visitors Bureau.
Lawyers for Alaska Senator Ted Stevens are entering the final phase of their case. They're trying to shoot down the government's claim that Stevens lied on his Senate forms about gifts worth more than $250,000, mostly from oil field services company Vico. As APRN's Libby Casey reports, the jury could begin deliberating on Monday.
Five more witnesses. That's all lawyers for Senator Stevens have planned. One of the names on that list, Senator Ted Stevens himself. He doesn't have to testify, and it's up in the air yet whether or not he'll actually take the stand. His wife, Catherine Stevens, is also on the defense team's potential witness list. The senator's lawyers lost a fight Tuesday to keep Catherine Stevens' emails from prosecutors. The judge ruled the government should be allowed to review them to see if they reference gifts the couple and their daughter allegedly received. Once the defense finishes making its case, prosecutors can call rebuttal witnesses. So far, they're planning on just three. Judge Emmett Sullivan predicts closing arguments and jury deliberation will start next Monday. However, jurors are now still deep in the listening phase of the trial. On Tuesday, they heard from an assortment of defense witnesses. Two testified to Stevens' character. Utah Senator Orrin Hatch called Stevens honest and straightforward and a true lion of the Senate. Yale University's chief financial officer, Gwen Sykes, a self-proclaimed Stevens groupie, talked about being an intern in Stevens' Senate office. She grew up in Anchorage and says Stevens' trust helped form her character. Prosecutors pointed out that Sykes worked for Stevens a decade before the time period he's accused of lying on his Senate forms. Two Alaska Native leaders testified about the positive attention they've received over the years from Senator Stevens, Doyon Regional Native Corporation board member Ori Williams, and the president of NANA Development Corporation, Helvi Sandvik. Both said Stevens responded to their organization's interests and did not favor Vico over them. However, the prosecution pointed out that NANA did partner with Vico on projects over the years. Senator Stevens' daughter, Susan Kovich, also testified. She talked about stopping at her father's Girdwood house on road trips. The senator was back in Washington, and Kovich assumed the house would be empty, but was surprised to find her father's friend there at times, Vico CEO Bill Allen. Susan Kovich described pulling in at the Girdwood house late at night, exhausted, only to find lights on and cars in the driveway, and Allen upstairs. Sometimes she went inside and slept on a couch or in a downstairs bedroom, but Kovich said sometimes it, quote, got too creepy, so she would drive on. A friend of Catherine Stevens also spoke as a witness. Jean Penny gave Catherine a $3,000 stained glass window as a housewarming present when the remodeling project was finished. The stained glass artist advertised it as being made for Senator Stevens, but Jean Penny said that wasn't exactly accurate. She said it was meant for Catherine and not the senator. During her testimony, however, Penny flip-flopped at times, saying the gift was for them, but she ended saying her intention was to give the gift to Catherine. Stevens' lawyers got into the meat of the house renovation project when they put contractor Augie Payone on the stand. He was paid by Catherine Stevens for carpentry work. Payone testified that Vico officials did initially ask him to work on the Stevens house and that he was supposed to send the invoices to Bill Allen with the understanding that Allen would approve them and forward them on to the Stevens couple. Payone testified it's not unusual for friends to oversee construction projects when homeowners are out of town. down, as was the Stevens couple. Payon said he was paid promptly 5 times by Catherine Stevens and for large amounts, but the final bill was never paid. Defense lawyers claim Catherine Stevens never saw it because Allen held it up and told Payon to, quote, eat it. They're trying to show it was Allen and not Ted Stevens, who was deceitful about money and gifts. Augie Payon never got to fully explain his take on the situation Tuesday because his testimony was interrupted by a legal dispute. His comments may contradict what Bill Allen said earlier in the trial. Lawyers are fighting over whether Payon can testify about what Allen or other Vico employees told him because it might be considered hearsay. The judge is expected to straighten out the matter before testimony begins again Wednesday morning. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Hidden beneath Alaska's coastal waters are the stuff of legends and folklore, shipwrecks. But instead of gold and jewels, most of the cargo still on board is hazardous. Dan Magone is a marine salvage expert out of Dutch Harbor. His favorite shipwreck story harkens back to the 60s. Magone says nuclear arms concerns prompted the U.S. Navy to fill an old vessel with World War II era ordnance.
You know, like mines and torpedoes and bombs and whatever. And they filled the ship up with it. I can't remember how many thousand tons of this stuff. And then they towed it out someplace where they knew nobody would care, which was the Aleutians.
They put a pressure-sensitive detonator on it, planning for it to explode when it sank to a certain depth. Only it didn't quite work out that way.
They cut it loose, and it disappeared into the fog, and it never blew up.
They reluctantly went looking for it, but didn't want to touch it.
So they brought in planes, and they bombed it to try to get it to blow up, because it didn't sink where it was supposed to. It had drifted into shallow water. And so they tried bombing it from the air a number of times, and that didn't work. So then they decided that it was safe.
Magone says the Navy publication he read didn't say where it is. He speculates that it's still classified.
So as far as the hazmat cargo that's sunk in Alaskan waters, I'd probably put that one somewhere near the top.
But military shenanigans aside, there are vessels in Alaskan waters that contain hazards that are all too common. Heavy fuel, possibly a lot of it, is still laying on the ocean bottom in the tanks of numerous wrecks.
This is a teacup from the Alaska Steamship Company. It has the logo of the steamship line on the front. And it's white with a kind of a blue-green accent.
Anchorage diver Steve Lloyd found the Aleutian in the summer of 2002. The vessel was virtually forgotten for 73 years, lying in Uyak Bay near Kodiak. The steamship sank in about 200 feet of water in 1929. Beyond coffee cups, compasses, and a bell from the steamer's bow, Lloyd and his partners also saw evidence of fuel still on the massive vessel. The ship could hold more than 400 passengers and up to 150 crew members. He says it would have been the practice back then to fuel up in Seattle.
Estimates are that it was probably between one-half and two-thirds full, which would have equaled perhaps as much as 150 to 175,000 gallons.
Lloyd says over the course of 3 summers, he and his dive partners saw evidence that fuel was leaking from the deteriorating tanks. He traces his finger over the area on a drawing of the vessel's structure.
There's the galley, and here's a fuel oil bunker just below it. So that suggests to us that what has happened, at least in the case of the, I believe that's the number 2 bunker tank, but at any rate, there's some fuel that has released probably from this tank or from this tank and has managed to go up 2 decks and is now pooling in the ceiling of the galley in the dining saloon.
After Lloyd and his partners formed a company to take others on dive tours of the Aleutian, the state suddenly wanted to claim ownership and used Lloyd's own information about the possibility of a fuel discharge from the decrepit tanks in court. The state said if Lloyd's crew were at the site and fuel dumped into the ocean, they would be responsible for potentially millions in cleanup costs. Lloyd says he hasn't returned to the site since the case, but he's surprised that in 4 years, state officials haven't taken any action.
As a resident of Alaska, I can't believe that there isn't someone at some level of state government whose job it is to pay attention to this stuff.
When these shipwrecks
are as old as this one, it's somewhat of a gray area.
Gary Folley works for the State Department of Environmental Conservation. He says the procedure for a ship that runs aground today is clear. Work with the Coast Guard, refloat the vessel, contain any spill, and remove the fuel. But it's not so clear in the case of a vessel that has been on the bottom for years.
There are literally hundreds of these shipwrecks throughout Alaskan waters, including 238 in the Kodiak area. And also, as a result of World War II actions, Kiska seems to be a popular place.
Folley says removing oil from submerged wrecks, especially thick bunker sea fuel, requires divers and equipment to drill into the tanks, heat the fuel to re-liquefy it, and suction it out. A similar effort near San Francisco cost $23 million. He says the state of Alaska has options available if a wreck needs attention, but it would be a tough sell in the case of the Aleutian.
We would have to make a determination and show that the risk of a spill, the threat to the environment or the public health and welfare is both substantial and imminent. And with the wreck this old and not actively leaking, it's difficult to make that argument.
Anchorage diver Steve Lloyd is unconvinced. He says even now, the Aleutian is crumbling into the ocean floor.
If through the state's inattention and inaction, the wreck is allowed to continue to deteriorate to the point where the oil is spontaneously released, it's going to be a major ecological nightmare, I don't believe is too strong a word. It depends how much is there. It could be a little bit, which would just be an icky mess and kill a few birds, or it could be a heck of a lot and completely foul Uyak Bay and the northwest coast of Kodiak Island.
Marine environmental experts estimate there are 8,000 large vessels sunk in coastal waters worldwide that have the potential to release significant amounts of old fuel. Many of these vessels are World War II-era ships, now about 60 years old, and probably suffering significant corrosion. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, calculating the cost of this summer's big flood.
Preliminary estimates have been for about $10.5 million worth of damages.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
And by BP, where training Alaska's future workforce is a priority.
A new study of Alaska's 2,000 largest glaciers shows 99% of them are shrinking. The U.S. Geological Survey paper traces the evolution of the state's glaciers as far back as 10,000 years. The findings confirm global warming has greatly accelerated the rate of retreat. USGS scientist Bruce Molnia is the study's author. He says there are more than 50,000 glaciers in Alaska and only a dozen that are known to be advancing.
Almost all of them have several things going for them. They're all located very close to the Pacific Ocean moisture source. So even though there may be other glaciers in the same general location who are close to the Pacific Ocean, these, in addition to that, have extremely large high elevation accumulation areas. So they have the ability to accumulate a large amount of precipitation where it's cold enough for that snow to become converted to glacier ice. The further north you get away from the coastline, the drier it is, and we see a lot of glaciers that are truly moisture-starved. So they're not getting enough precipitation, even if the temperatures were cold enough to replenish them. And the state of Alaska has about 21 first-order weather stations throughout the state. When you look at the last 60 years of temperature records, there is almost a 4-degree Fahrenheit increase in temperature throughout the state. So that's having a major impact on why the greatest majority are retreating.
The study that you put together is quite comprehensive, dating back 10,000 years in some respects. What were some of the most surprising findings that you came across that you included in this study?
There is a substantial loss of glacier ice on the summit of Mount Wrangell. Now, Mount Wrangell isn't responding to climate. It's responding to an artifact of the 1964 earthquake. 64 earthquake caused almost a order of magnitude increase in the heat flow under Mount Wrangell. So there is this heat coming up from the crust of the earth that's caused the crater of Mount Wrangell to lose half of its glacier ice since 1964. Another one is that there are three glaciers in western Prince William Sound, all south-facing glaciers, Harvard to the west, Yale in the middle, and Mears to the east. Harvard and Mears are both advancing while Yale is retreating. They all come out of the Chugach Mountains, but they have distinctive characteristics that have resulted in their behavior being very, very different from their immediately adjacent neighbor.
And why is that?
Well, in that particular case, Yale is at a lower accumulation area and has a smaller percentage of its accumulation area at higher altitude than either Mears or Harvard. Also, it's probably got a wider valley, and it's immediately south-facing, so it probably has its own little microclimate where it's warmer than Mears is. Harvard, on the other hand, has the highest accumulation area of all of them, and probably is nourished by a number of tributary glaciers that also accumulate glacier ice and snow at high elevations.
As you're well aware, this past summer was unusually cold and wet. How could that possibly affect glaciers in Alaska, or can it? Was it enough of a weather change to affect them?
It probably resulted in a reduced rate of melting, although there definitely was significant melting. I work with a group at Bering Glacier, and in the past, we would have up to 5 to 6 feet of melting during a typical normal, quote-unquote, summer. This year, it was about half that, and it occurred much later than previous years. In the higher accumulation areas, there probably is more snow remaining this year than any time in the last decade. This 1 year, though, is not going to be enough to have a major impact on changing the behavior of the glacier.
How many years of similar weather would it take to reverse the trend of retreat in glaciers?
It depends on the glacier size. Some glaciers, such as small hanging glaciers, it would take, you know, just a handful of years, 5 to 10 years, to see an appreciable change. Some glaciers, like the Bering, probably take 400 years of long-term buildup before you saw the terminus growing. Terminus being at sea level in an area where it's been retreating up to a third of a mile a year.
And how does this square with information about overall global warming? As a scientist, are you concerned that people may get confused or have doubts about scientific findings if there are reports pointing to warming and ice decline, but also a study that shows possible cooling?
The answer is yes. I have been following a number of the articles that reported on the release of this USGS professional paper. And some of them have had as many as 250 or 300 comments. And just reading the comments, you get everything from, see, global warming isn't real, to, yeah, but what does this really mean in terms of the big picture? And so it's clear that there's a lot of both confusion and misinformation that has circulated through the public. And, you know, depending on how the media displays the results of the study, they may either help to assuage concerns about whether this is a real long-term change or confuse the matter.
Bruce Molnia is a USGS scientist and an adjunct professor at UAF. Links to the report and pictures of glaciers can be found at our website, aprn.org. After some initial problems, the state's energy rebate program has gone through some changes to help people who want to weatherize their homes. The program reimburses homeowners up to $10,000 for weatherization expenses that decrease their energy consumption. The program was approved during this year's regular legislative session and increased during the special session, now with an appropriation of $160 million. Brian Butcher with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation says the biggest problem so far has been a shortage of energy raters, the people who make the initial estimates of energy efficiency. He says there are now more people trained for the task and more are on the way.
most Alaskans weren't able to get phone calls back or were being told to call back in January. Even getting on a list at all was very difficult. And as fast as we've been training raiders, and we have been training them as fast as we can, we've over doubled the number of raiders statewide in the last few months. It's still a tremendous demand. And so we looked at what would be the best way of trying to get a system set up where Alaskans could get a voice, could get on a list, and could be able to monitor the list.
Homeowners are now asked to sign up either through a website, akrebate.com, or calling a toll-free number to start the process. AHFC will then keep a master list for raters to use to schedule their initial assessments. Homeowners can also check the list to determine how long they will have to wait. Butcher says as of last Friday, AHFC had processed 2,500 initial requests, although he expects between 4,000 and 5,000 ratings have been completed.
And the number of Alaskans that have actually had their rating, gotten the work done, and then had the post rating to request the energy rebate is at 65 people. So a month or so ago, it was only at 8 or 9. So slowly, since the program's been around a few months more, it's giving more people time to actually get the work done. So we're starting to get more applications in for the finished, for the completion of the rebate process.
Butcher says many people are doing the smaller efficiency jobs for themselves, caulking or insulation, for example, and he anticipates that building contractors will become more available during the winter for some of the more involved projects. He says people have up to 18 months from the initial rating to complete the work and file for the rebate.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the University of Alaska College Savings Plan, providing tax-advantaged college savings options for Alaska families. T. Rowe Price Investment Services Incorporated, distributor, underwriter. Information at 1-888-4, and then Alaska. And by Wells Fargo. Manage accounts, pay bills, and get instant loan decisions online at wellsfargo.com. The next stage.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
Federal Emergency Management Administration officials are documenting damage from the summer rain and wind storm that caused flooding and other damage in interior and northern Alaska. Alaska Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management spokesman Jeremy Zydek says the assessment triggered by last month's federal disaster declaration shows substantial impacts to public infrastructure.
Preliminary estimates have been for about $10.5 million worth of damages.
Zydek says high-dollar impacts include damage to a seawall in the North Slope village of Wainwright. Federal money will cover 75% of public infrastructure damage, with the state responsible for the remaining 25%. He says the weather event, which caused the worst flooding in Fairbanks and Nenana in 40 years, did not cause enough damage to private property to qualify homeowners for federal relief, but that more than 200 homeowners have applied to receive $5,000 assistance grants available from the state. The Minerals Management Service is planning to study subsistence activity along the North Aleutian Basin to prepare for opening up the area for an oil and gas lease sale proposed for 2011. For member station KDLG, Adam Kane reports.
The three-year, $340,000 study, which will be used to evaluate potential mitigation measures and stipulations, was awarded to Idaho State University. Public Affairs Officer for the MMS Alaska Region, Robin Casey, explains what they will be looking for.
Subsistence activities are very important to rural communities, and we want to know or learn how subsistence how prevalent subsistence is in the area, how the sharing occurs, so we can better tailor our sale to minimize any impacts on local communities.
Those communities included in the study are Port Hyden, Nelson Lagoon, Akatam, and False Pass. Those villages are the main areas of focus due to their proximity to the proposed sale area. They will not, however, be studying the northern Bristol Bay region, which is one of the proposed development's biggest opponents. From the study, the MMS will gain a detailed description of the types and amounts of food resources that are harvested in those communities. Sectors of the distribution network are also being studied for vulnerabilities that could occur as a result of industrial development. A study this in-depth will take some time to complete.
It's a 3-year study, so they will be starting in a few months going to individual villages. They'll be doing interviews, surveys of adults in the village about subsistence practices, and try to put together a baseline data set on subsistence needs and activities in the areas.
Following the 3-year study, Idaho State University will prepare a report outlining their findings, and that report will be completed just in time for the proposed oil and gas lease sale, which is also set to begin in 3 years. Casey says this will be one of many studies that will be considered when drafting the final environmental impact statement.
Because we haven't had a lease sale in this particular area for a number of years, we are sponsoring a number of studies to help bring us up to date on the environmental and social conditions in the area, subsistence areas that we need to consider for special protection because they're a very discrete ecosystem, endangered species, all of that. All of those studies reports will be considered while we're doing the draft and final environmental impact statement, and then all of that information will be used to make the decision on whether or not to hold the sale.
People in the Northern Bristol Bay region who want to submit comments to the MMS still have the option.
They can send comments to MMS about their subsistence use and any sharing that they do, and we will send it to the study coordinator here within MMS.
Comments are encouraged and can be submitted through email directly to the MMS at akwebmaster@mms.gov. In Dillingham, I'm Adam Kane.
A bear cub found dead in Sitka's Starrigavin Valley last week appears to have been killed by another bear. The cub is believed to have been one of a pair of twins who spent the summer feeding with a sow. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
A Forest Service timber crew discovered the cub's carcass on October 2nd while marking a stand for thinning. Law enforcement ranger Mike Welsh says that the animal was found mostly intact and close to the road, but did not show any sign of a bullet wound, being hit by a car, or other man-made trauma. Instead, the carcass appeared partially eviscerated, which is characteristic of a bear kill. When Welsh went out the following day to recover the carcass, it had been dragged much farther from the road and the hindquarters had been taken. Again, evidence that the cub had been prey to an adult bear, probably a large male or boar. Welsh bagged the carcass and took it to state biologist Phil Mooney, who confirmed the cause of death. Mooney says that it is very common in the natural world for adult grizzlies to feed on cubs, especially as the cubs grow a little older and tend to drift from their sows. The time of year is also significant. Mooney says that as boars conclude feeding at salmon streams and begin to head to their dens, they'll sometimes cross paths with cubs, and it usually does not end happily for the latter. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Adam Kane in Dillingham, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. The Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. And by Condor Airlines, offering nonstop service to Frankfurt from Anchorage and Fairbanks between May and September, with connections to most German and European destinations. Details available at condor.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.